Gamley. This is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. As if the partial government shutdown weren't enough, another fiscal fight in Washington is emerging over the debt ceiling. The U.S. will soon once again hit the limit of its borrowing authority beyond the $16.7 trillion currently allowed. The Treasury Department says that day will come on October 17th. In the past, this ceiling has been raised without much commentary, but in recent years, Congress has come close to not lifting the limit several times, bringing us events such as the fiscal cliff, the supercommittee, the sequester, warnings about government default, and more recently, talk of whether the president should invoke the 14th Amendment. Now, you're to be forgiven if you don't remember what the 14th Amendment says. It's mostly about reintegrating former Confederate states back into our political system and is best known for its guarantee that those states give former slaves equal protection. But it's Section 4 of this amendment that's coming up now with its language about the validity of the public debt. Constitutional experts dispute what this really means and who's in charge of ensuring that validity, the president or the Congress. Today in The Exchange, we look at this coming debt ceiling debate from a different angle. What does the Constitution say? And what does being faithful to the Constitution require us to do? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. We have two guests from D.C. who've both written extensively on this topic. David Rivkin served in the Justice Department during the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations. He's an attorney at a law firm in D.C. He specializes in constitutional, administrative, and international litigation. And David Rivkin, it's great to have you. Thanks a lot for your time.
Pleasure to be with you.
Also with us, Garrett Epps, former reporter for The Washington Post, novelist, legal scholar. He teaches constitutional law and creative writing at the University of Baltimore. Garrett Epps' books include Democracy Reborn, The 14th Amendment, and The Fight for Equal Rights in Post-Civil War America, and American Epic, Reading the U.S. Constitution. And Garrett Epps, great to have you, too. Thank you for being with us.
Great to be here.
Well, and gentlemen, before we get into this constitutional question, and that is what I want to focus on for the hour, but just to get some very basic business out of the way, David, if we could, please. Real basic, in fact, what is the debt ceiling?
The debt ceiling is a fairly recent statutory innovation from 1789 to 1917. Congress, consistent with authority under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 2, authorized specific loans and specific tranches of debts to finance specific projects and activities. That changed with exigencies of World War One that strained the federal budget and caused Congress in a series of statutes to take a different approach, basically authorizing Treasury to issue debt on various denominations, various terms, in response to market conditions as need arises, while capping aggregate level of debt. This is, in essence, the system that we have today.
And this is really basic, too, okay? So forgive me. But, David, so what's the difference between the federal government's debt ceiling and, you know, your average family's debt ceiling? Are there analogies there, or is it a totally different animal?
No, they're sort of, Laura, not a bad analogy would be to say the debt ceiling is the total amount of credit you have, lines of credit, lines in your credit cards. You don't need to draw against them, but you know that if you have a payment to make, you can go and withdraw from that credit limit.
Yeah, and Garrett Epps, a question for you. Why do we call it a debt ceiling if it keeps getting raised? It doesn't seems like a pretty porous ceiling. We keep bumping it up.
Well, Henry Aaron of the Brookings Institution this week said that the debt ceiling is to statutes what the vermiform appendix is to the human body. That is, it's an organ that, as far as we can tell, has no known function. The debt ceiling itself doesn't say that money shan't be borrowed. It doesn't include a direction to any particular official. It just says it may not exceed a certain amount. And, you know, the interpretation of it is a complicated business. I think you could read it to say that we want to maintain a kind of bookkeeping process by which when you know, it's sort of like you make a note to yourself saying, keep track of all credit expenses. When my credit card bills reach a certain level, maybe I should look at my expenses and see if I need to cut them back. David used an analogy that might be a little confusing because he says it's like the credit limit on your credit card. It's really not. We can continue to borrow money as we need to. It's more like a little note you made to yourself saying don't borrow more than X, which is fine, but it calls into question whether you could tell your creditors, gosh, I'd like to pay you the money I owe you, but I made a note to myself and I put it in my pocket saying that I wouldn't owe more than a certain amount, and I can't violate the note in my pocket, so you don't mind if I don't pay you. It's a very curious statute.
Still, it sounds,
point with respect, this is not quite true. In my analogy, the reason it's apropos, you unilaterally, Garrett, cannot increase your credit limit. You can go back to the folks who authorize it, and they may or may not give you an increase. The important thing for your listeners to appreciate that in our constitutional system, Article 1, Congress, Section 2, Clause 2, says to borrow money on the credit of the United States. That is a plenary power of Congress. That power in no way, form, or shape is vested in executive branch, which is Article 2. That's why Congress in this case is the entity authorizing the increase in the credit limit. Article 2 is the borrower who can go borrow against it. It is not a unilateral note to oneself. That is an essential part of a checks and balances that permeates our constitutional architecture. Power of a purse is the key congressional power.
Well, I definitely want to get into the different articles of the Constitution, what they say. We've got the 14th Amendment, we got Congress and the power of the purse. But one more quick question about the debt ceiling itself. And for you, Garrett, you know, you made that analogy from the Brookings Institution, Henry Aaron made. The debt ceiling has no known function. It's like an appendix. You know, we don't really know why we have it. But that sort of analogy that you drew, Garrett, that reminder that, gee, we maybe really shouldn't go over this amount because that represents overspending, that sounds more useful than an appendix.
Well, it would be useful. It is useful and I think has been useful over the years as a reminder that we ought to periodically sit down and look at our financial situation and debate which way we're going. And that's how it's been used over the years. A certain amount of political theater, but what happens is the executive notifies Congress that the debt ceiling is being approached. We need an authorization to raise it. Members of Congress get up and they say, I think we should raise it because we're at war, or they say, I think we are spending too much and we should cut X before we raise it, which on the whole is a healthy debate. But I don't know of another occasion on which one House of Congress or the majority in one House of Congress has said, and perhaps they won't say it. They haven't said it yet. But I don't know of a situation where the majority of one House of Congress has said, you know, we have a difference with the opinion with the administration about health care policy, which is unrelated to the issue of the debt. And so we think we should default on our sovereign debt because we're unhappy with the administration. That's really very hard for me to see that that's the function of the debt ceiling.
I really want to get into this issue of default with you guys, because I know, David, you have some different opinions there. But let me also invite our listeners to join us. The number 1-800-892-6477. Today in the Exchange, we're looking at what the Constitution says about the federal debt as another debt ceiling deadline looms on top of the government shutdown. We're looking at what our nation's defining document says about this, the 14th Amendment and other amendments, as we heard a moment ago. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Okay, guys, so the 14th Amendment. This is what's come up in conversation just recently, and both of you have written a lot about this. And David, to you first, just stepping back from today for a moment, if we could. The 14th Amendment comes around the Reconstruction era, the Civil War era, very well known for its Equal Protection Clause, saying that former Confederate states need to extend equal protection to former slaves. But then it goes on to talk about debt. So what does the 14th Amendment, David, say about debt?
Well, Section 4 of the 14th Amendment says, and you're absolutely right, Laura, in describing its genesis, that public debt of the United States shall not be questioned. Very important to underscore what it means. If you look at the drafting of this language, original term used. Well, let me back up and just mention a little bit of history. The reason this language came about is because the United States was not, repeat, not going to pay the debt obligations incurred by the Confederate States. Because as far as we were concerned, they were in a state of rebellion, and those debts were not something we cared to pay. And I mean, the United States wanted to reassure the world that that was a one-time thing, that our sovereign debt was perfectly safe. So the United States is one of a few countries, perhaps the only country in the world, whose public debt, true public debt, is constitutionally guaranteed. And the reason we know what it's, what I mean is true public debt, it does not mean all obligations of the United States, Laura. It means only bonds and other forms of debts for whatever purposes incurred issued to third parties. The original draft of the 14th Amendment used the broader word obligations. It was replaced with debt. If you look at the language of the Section 4 itself, it clearly distinguishes debt and other types of obligations. And there are a couple of leading Supreme Court cases that I would not bear the bore you with names that make eminently clear that while true public debt is guaranteed, other obligations like Social Security, Medicaid payments, et cetera, are not guaranteed. So very important for your listeners to understand. This is a very important confrontation we're talking about. But true public debt payments, principal and interest to bondholders, are not an issue. If Treasury ever were not to pay them, one can trot quickly to the Federal Court of Claims, which is just a couple of blocks from my office, get a money judgment against the United States. That is a totally false note in the narrative, but unfortunately, the administration has been playing since 2011 to magnify its leverage. Now, I'm not saying it's cricket. There are other obligations that people depend on, Social Security payments, Medicare, Medicaid, but it's not a question of default on our public debt.
All right, and let's talk after a break. And Garrett, I'll go to you about this idea of what public debt is, debt versus obligation and the distinction there. We'll also take your questions and comments about what the Constitution says about the debt and particularly this debt ceiling debate that is approaching. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. When you become an NHPR sustaining member, you help NHPR collect an additional $10,000. When 500 listeners become sustainers, we'll receive $10,000 from the Mackinich Foundation and cancel a day from our upcoming fall fund drive. You listen to NHPR. Now it's time to support and sustain us at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from New Hampshire Orthopedic Center, keeping bodies in motion on the web at nhoc.com. From Harvest Capital, helping families in New Hampshire and across the nation increase financial security in these changing times, information at harvestcap.com. And from Panema Green Family Golf Center in Amherst, providing families with outdoor fun, golf, mini golf, lessons, driving range, and the new Grill 122. Details at playamherst.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a constitutional look at the federal debt. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. 1-800-892-6477. Send a short email to exchange at nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. We're looking at what the Constitution says about the federal debt, the difference between debt and obligations as another debt ceiling deadline looms on top of a government shutdown. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. David Rivkin is with us and also Garrett Epps, and both gentlemen have written extensively on this. We're going to put their articles up on our website, nhpr.org, so you can take a look at them there, nhpr.org. Before we go to our listeners, gentlemen, Garrett Epps, I did want to give you a chance to jump in on this idea, and it's an important concept to wrap our heads around. The 14th Amendment talks about debt. David is making the distinction between debt and obligation, true public debt versus obligations like Social Security payments and other government programs. Go ahead, Garrett. I'd love your thoughts on that, too. What does public debt mean exactly?
Well, I believe David described public debt more or less correctly. That is the provisions that the 14th Amendment itself guarantees. The other payments that he describes, such as Social Security, with the implication that the federal government can pay or withhold them, you know, as the president chooses, are actually obligations of the United States under valid statutes passed by Congress, not repealed, and thus are obligatory on the United States under Article 6, Section 2, so that the president really doesn't legally have the authority to say, gosh, we're a little short today, we won't pay Social Security. That law directs him to, you know, to pay those. So there's a whole set of laws that are involved here, and the president might be put in a position where he has to break some of them, and arguably the debt ceiling statute would be everyone's first choice. Now, the second thing I want to say about the 14th Amendment is, you know, David's description of its history was almost right, because he really was describing the wrong clause of Section 4, that is the clause that bars the repayment of the Confederate debt. The clause that guarantees the validity of the public debt was spurred by a very particular political situation, and that was this, which is documented in my book. After the Civil War, the former Confederate leaders announced, they were very open about it. They said, we are going back into Congress, we are going to elect members of Congress, we're going back and we're going to take over, we're going to be more powerful than ever before, we'll have more representation than before the Civil War, and we will make sure that the federal government doesn't pay the national debt that it acquired during the Civil War. The national debt had increased 40-fold during the Civil War. We're going to make sure the United States does not repay the bondholders who lent the government money to defeat the South. We don't think that those people deserve repayment. So this clause was put in the Constitution to prevent a situation in which one political faction comes into Congress and decides that because of its political values, it doesn't want the debt repaid. And in that sense, you know, you can draw your own conclusions about whether it's applicable to the situation today.
So what do you think about that, David? Does it apply today or not? I'm hearing sort of two shades of opinion here.
Of course it applies today. First of all, I'm glad that Garrett and I agree on what is the word debt mean in the context of a 14th Amendment, Section 4. It is absolutely true that one of the purposes of that language is to ensure that future Congresses, which, as Keith points out correctly, may be dominated demographically, as was the case prior to Civil War, not anymore, by the South, would, in essence, try to disparage or question, vitiate true public debt. That is an absolutely binding obligation. What I think is important for your listeners to appreciate, however, that all the other obligations by the sovereign, while politically important, morally important, are not constitutionally guaranteed. And I totally with respect disagree with Garrett that just because the government has made promises to the people, to the extent that there's not enough money in the federal treasury to pay them all, but the president can go and raise debt on his own or raise taxes, as some people have suggested, on their own, there'll be an utterly ultra-virus unconstitutional act. And the Supreme Court said very clearly, and I promise not to mention case names, but the case is called Fleming versus Nestor, 1960 Supreme Court case. The court said very clearly that other obligations of a sovereign, including the ones to which the United States are a party, are always subject to revision. Just think about it my way for a second. Under Garrett's view, everything would be a one-way ratchet. So let's say Congress promises in an authorizing statute in Social Security to pay folks, $500 a month. Can Congress not go back because of fiscal situation and change it to $400? Of course it can. It can either do it by passing a new authorizing statute, or an equally valid exercise of legislative power would be to provide only enough money in the fisc to pay $400. Both are equally valid exercise of legislative power. Neither actually is breaking in any way the Constitution, and there's nothing that the president can do about that. Well, it has nothing to do with 14th Amendment.
Got a couple more questions on the president, the Congress, and so forth, but I want to invite our listeners to join us as well. And the number is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, we're taking a constitutional look at the federal debt ceiling debate that, as we hear, is looming. 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And Judy's calling first from Queechee, Vermont. Hi, Judy. Thanks for hanging on. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Sure.
I would like to make a comment about the whole issue of the debt ceiling. Forget the constitutional arguments. The fact of the matter is that the debt ceiling is to pay bills that Congress has already authorized and or appropriated. It is not for new money to be produced by the president. So it's a false argument. I mean, and this issue of the debt that he was just talking about with the Constitution, public debt versus private debt versus what the president authorizes, Congress proposes and the president disposes. So Congress is now saying we authorize all this money without any budgets, by the way, for the last 17 years or so that they haven't put a budget together. And now all of a sudden, oh, my goodness, we're going to stop it and we're going to threaten to stop it because we don't like a bill that's passed. That's what's unconstitutional. It's a bunch of thugs trying to change the meaning of what the debt ceiling is and what is to be done. And I'll hang up and listen to the comments afterwards.
Judy, thank you very much. And, you know, this is what the Treasury Secretary said recently. He said, hey, this isn't about new spending. It's about covering expenses. Congress and the President have already agreed to. I'd love to hear from both of you on this. Go ahead, Garrett, you first.
Well, that is absolutely correct. And the idea that somehow we're authorizing new programs, that is, that this involves the president in some way using the power of the purse, I think is an equivocation. That's really not correct. It is the president following his statutory duty to pay for programs that Congress has enacted. Now, David made a very valid point. Congress doesn't have to pay Social Security payments at the authorized level. All it needs to do is repeal the Social Security statute and enact a new one, but it hasn't done that. So the idea that Congress can sort of say, we don't feel like changing this note in our pocket, and therefore the Social Security statute is no longer valid, I think that's really profoundly mistaken. These authorizing statutes are not subject to the government shutdown. They don't require annual appropriations. They direct the president to pay these programs at a certain level. They remain valid, and nothing in the failure to enact a debt ceiling repeals them. The president, as under Article 2, has the duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. These are part of the law, just as Section 4 of the 14th Amendment is. And when Congress, by not passing a bill, thinks that it can force the president to violate other statutes, I think we have a fairly serious constitutional dispute.
Well, David, go ahead, jump in, and then I've got another question for you.
Constitutional dispute. I think your caller operates under a very wrong conception of a constitution. With respect, so does Garrett. Let me explain. They're indeed long-term authorizing statutes. However, from time immemorial in our constitutional system, authorizing statutes that do something other than impose non-financial obligations on the government. Let's say the authorizing statutes which indicate how the government should organize itself, how it should function in dealing with certain disputes, are always in force. Any authorizing statute that requires the expenditure of money is not, repeat, not the law of the land at any given point in time unless there is enough money in the FISC to pay those obligations. And it's interesting because Garrett and I clearly very crisply disagree on this point, because he said if there's an authorizing statute, that's already an obligation that the government has to honor. It is not the case. If there's no money in the Treasury, the president under our Constitution has no power to raise revenue, either for borrowing or by increasing, selling federal assets or passing new taxes. All those powers belong to Congress. And I can tell you from the day of the earliest Congress, Congress from time to time, about changing authorizing statutes, has varied their import. For example, we have almost annually so-called appropriation riders. So Congress would say there's an authorizing statute telling EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, or HHS to do something. Congress would say no dollars Garrett shall be spent doing X, Y, and Z. And guess what? Totally constitutional. The authorizing statute, for as long as this appropriation rider lasts, would not be able to comply with authorizing statutes. Nobody has ever suggested that that presents an instance where some authorizing statute is being broken. They are supplanted. You have a subsequent congressional action in a form of an appropriation item that varies the impact of an authorizing statute. That way Congress has routinely varied the impact of authorizing statute is, frankly, dealt to the Defense Department. Their long-term authorizing statute, which says you should have a following end strengths as far as your infantry or Air Force or the Navy is concerned. If there's not enough money in the defense budget, Garrett, do you think the DOD can go and contract with private sector and buy new planes, ships?
David, can I ask you a quick question? Garrett and David, can I ask you a quick question? There's a lot of language here that's sort of inside the beltway, and I just want to make it crystal clear for folks. So, David, authorizing statute, that is when when the president and Congress say, we want to spend money on X, and then lo and behold, it turns out there's no money in the Treasury to do so. You're saying that's constitutional not to pay those bills.
That's constitutional in a sense that the power to generate revenue and power to indicate how much money can be spent in any given fiscal year is primarily congressional. If there's not enough money, all it does is it's a subsequent Congress making a change to the original authorizing statute. You can either do it by amending the authorizing statute itself, which Garrett acknowledges, or simply starving it of funds. That is entirely constitutional.
That's not default.
That's not default at all. It's not. But, I mean, what I'm talking now, or about the 14th Amendment, Garrett seems to be suggesting that because past Congresses have passed enacted a given authorizing statute that requires, back to my hypothetical, everybody in the United States to get $500 every month, that somehow that imposes an obligation on the president to pay $500. And my answer is that's not true. It is the case only if there's enough money in the Treasury to pay $500, either through tax revenue or borrowing, and tax revenue levels and borrowing levels are determined by Congress. That is plenary congressional power.
All right, let me jump in here because we've got Maria in New Ipswich.
I mean, we've just
Garrett, go ahead.
Maybe I could answer some of the questions that have been
Go ahead, Garrett, and then I do want to get to our listeners
Some of the representations of what I undoubtedly think from David, and perhaps it's better if I say what I actually think. First of all, I just want to say for the record, I got a pretty good sense of what a constitution is. I appreciate the lesson, David, but your examples are not on point because you keep saying Congress can change these authorizing statutes. I don't disagree. It hasn't done that. If the Republican majority in the House would like to introduce cuts to Social Security, would like to introduce cuts to veterans' benefits, would like to introduce cuts to the farm subsidy programs, there's no question that if they can get them passed, then those would affect those obligations. But, of course, they haven't done that. There's no appropriation riders that have been passed. And so the statutes are valid. And what Congress has done is, or may do, because maybe they won't, is to put the president in a situation where he has to disobey some provision of the Constitution or some statute. And the answer seems to be, well, you know, he can just pick and choose what he pays. I'm not sure that we want presidents picking and choosing which statutes they follow. But if they're put in that situation, it's not clear to me why the debt ceiling takes precedence over the dozens of authorizing statutes or over Section 4 of the 14th Amendment. I think it's a very difficult question. And I think that to say Congress has plenary power is a little bit of an oversimplification. No one questions that Congress has plenary power over appropriations, and that is because of language that is contained in Article 1, Section 9. But the power to borrow money on the credit of the United States is laid out in Article 1, Section 8, and the language doesn't clearly make it exclusive to Congress. It simply says Congress has that power. Since the days of Hamilton, we've had a number of situations where Congress and the president have been considered to have concurrent powers. And I think there is a reasonable argument that this may be one of them. Hamilton
where they have concurrent
said,
powers. Even though we always hear, Garrett, that Congress has the power of the purse. That's
it does have the power of the purse. That's a different power. That is the power to appropriate money from the Treasury.
I see.
Not the power to borrow money to pay debts that the Congress has already incurred. That's a different power.
I would love to bring our listeners back into this. And Maria is waiting in New Ipswich. Maria, you've been real patient. Thanks for hanging on. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. Hey, I'm not a constitutional scholar, but I like to think I'm a logical human being. And every business, probably not every family, but most people have, whether it's written on paper, an innate budget. And it seems to me this is all ridiculous. We are somehow, I know that it's all extremely complicated, probably more money than I can comprehend. But if the bottom line is, we have more obligations than we have money for. We've managed to get ourselves set up in a crazy mess. And if we are in the situation where to pay the current bills that we already have or, quote, obligations, we have to keep on borrowing money, somewhere in writing there should be something that says, this has got to stop. There's got to be a limit.
So the idea of a limit is appealing to you, Maria. At some point, you got to stop the overspending.
Right. If it has to be in writing because it says there's only so much you can borrow, then that's the way. Because so far, the Congress has not figured out how to do this. It's gone on and on and on, and no one has figured out how to manage to get it in control and have a budget that works. And if I and my family have a budget, and maybe I have some problems or some money doesn't come in, and I have promised my daughter a toy. You know, it's sad to say, but on Friday I'll have to say, gee, honey, we can't go to Walmart and buy that toy because we ran out of money. And I feel like, you know, somebody has to own up to that and start saying, you know, this isn't going to work. We cannot keep giving out money we don't have until it's at the expense of crippling the American public with taxes and everything else to pay it. I mean,
all right, and Maria, I got to jump in. I do apologize. We're heading into a break, but I hear your point, and we will follow up after a short break. This idea of the debt ceiling is a useful limit on overspending, as Maria puts it. We'll take more of your questions and comments, too, after that super short break. The number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And when we come back, our guests on Maria's point and more on what the Constitution says about the federal debt. Stay with us.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, dysfunction in Washington and U.S. power and credibility abroad. Then new efforts to combat human trafficking. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, Zem from Heritage Plumbing, Heating, Cooling. For any plumbing, heating, cooling, or drain problem, offering annual tune-ups and efficient heating systems online at justcallheritage.com. And the Music Hall of Portsmouth presenting comedian musician Reggie Watts, improvising the night through voice and looping pedals, October 6th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets at themusichall.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Email us at exchange@nhpr.org or comment on Facebook at NHPR Exchange before the program, and then join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today in The Exchange, we're taking a look at what the Constitution says about federal debt, obligations, as we're hearing, and who's in charge of ensuring that the validity of the public debt is maintained, the president or the Congress. We welcome your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And gentlemen, before we go back to our listeners, I did want to pick up on Maria's point. And Maria, thanks a lot for calling in. And David, she was saying, look, the debt ceiling is a useful tool. It helps us keep a lid on spending and not spend more than we can really afford. Go ahead, David.
I'm in accord with your caller. Let me say this. The framers would be rolling in their graves if they saw the current situation. They understood debt. And let's think about it, what it means when we borrow money. It's a burden we're putting on future generations. The debt in their mind and for decades thereafter, well over a century, was incurred only for really unusual and emergency purposes, to fight a war, to finance a one-time creation of a public infrastructure, things that were either impossible to avoid, like wars and calamities, or productive investments in the future. We now borrow, we're living beyond our means, approximately 43 cents of every dollar that we spend is being borrowed. We're borrowing an unsustainable rate. We're going to experience a real default at some point in time in the future because of a sheer weight of a debt, and we're putting burdens on the future generations. That's point number one. Point number two, Congress does have, apropos of Garrett's observation, Congress has absolutely plenary power under Section 8.
Plenary means
money.
Complete power.
Right.
Okay.
Correct. To borrow money on the credit of the United States. I don't know of anybody who suggested otherwise. And by the way, if it were otherwise, then congressional spending power would be entirely irrelevant because instead and power to raise taxes, because the president can outflank Congress entirely by just borrowing money. So that is not the case. Very important, however, for your listeners to appreciate that there's one category of obligations that is constitutionally sacred, and this is why we're having this discussion, because of a Section 4 of the 14th Amendment. The true public debt, bonds, principal and interest, another type of borrowing held by third parties, is sacred, sacrosanct. It has to be paid.
That's your
everything
distinction between
else,
debt and obligations that
right,
you talked about
right,
earlier.
Right.
I want to get
everything
Garrett
else,
in this as well.
Just briefly, everything else is always up for grabs on an annual basis. So when the United States government makes a promise, apropos of your caller's point about the toy, in an authorizing statute, what it really means implicitly is we promise XYZ of worth of largesse to you, provided next year Congress appropriates enough money for it. And if it does not, then you don't get it.
Let's get Garrett into this as well. And then we've got lots of listeners who want to jump in our conversation as well. Maria, thanks a lot for that call. And Garrett, what do you think about Maria's point? Go ahead, please.
Well, I certainly think that Congress, that there's a reason to be concerned about debt. And I would like to, as we all know, the federal deficit has fallen by about half in the past 5 years. So, you know, this concern about debt has been heard in Washington. Whether it's being effectually addressed or not, I don't know, could probably be more effectually addressed by actual negotiations over the budget. And please remember, those of you listening, the current threat of default has nothing to do with the budget deficit. The Republicans in the House are holding up the government and possibly the debt ceiling because they don't like health policy, which is not a question of how much debt the government has. It's something entirely irrelevant. For that reason, I think we should be very careful not to confuse our policy views about, you know, where the government should be spending money with our legal views of what the situation the government faces if we have one part of one house of Congress that simply refuses to do its duty. And if we want to discuss what would have the framers rolling in their graves, the idea that what Madison called one faction, that is a group of people with an interest adverse to the public, would simply paralyze the government rather than participate in the deliberative process that the framers anticipated, I think that would be the most shocking thing of all.
Garrett, let me ask you a question that you've written about a lot lately. You said there's a debate going on in Washington as to whether the president should, quote, invoke the 14th Amendment. So what does that mean exactly, to invoke the 14th Amendment?
Well, I think there's a pattern in American history. I'll try not to make this too inside baseball. But throughout American history, beginning with Hamilton and Washington in Washington's first term, The executive has put forward the argument that when the federal government has a power, and that power is not clearly and exclusively assigned to the legislature, and that power is executive in nature, then it belongs to the president. And my argument has been, because frankly, I don't want to see this happen. This is not something I'm excited about.
This meaning default?
This meaning presidential so-called invocation of Section 4.
No, go ahead.
What I want to see is Congress and the president, you know, doing business. But the fact of the matter is that in emergencies, such as 1861, such as, you know, the early years of Washington's term with the war between England and France, the president has stepped up and said, there is an executive responsibility that must be fulfilled now. I will do it now and submit it to the judgment of Congress later. So the Section 4 of the 14th Amendment is not directed to Congress. It doesn't say, it could have said easily, Congress shall not refuse to pay the debts, or whatever language you want to imagine. It says the validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, ellipsis, shall not be questioned. To my mind, that's extraordinary language. It's directed to all three branches of the federal government. And if we face an emergency situation where Congress simply refuses to do its job, then the president, I think, would not be doing something historically unprecedented by saying, this devolves on me. I am the government organ of last resort. It would be, unprecedented. We wouldn't know the answer. I think the only way we would ever find out whether this was justified would be for a president to do it and then be subject to impeachment proceedings. And if he was impeached and removed, then we'd all know he doesn't have that power.
That's a pretty risky strategy.
Well, default is a risky strategy, too.
If I may, David, go ahead, jump in,
and then I've got another caller. Go ahead,
very
David.
Very briefly, I cannot disagree more profoundly. And then I thought Garrett and I agreed, by the way, that Section 4 guarantees only true public debt. And the fact of the matter is, despite the fact that 43 cents on every dollar we spend is being borrowed, there's sufficient tax revenues to pay for public, true public debt, principal and interest. So that's not in default. That's we're not in any danger of default on that. That's a false argument. But the broader point is, I'm a huge fan of executive power, Article 2 to be technical. I never worked for Congress. I spent much of my career in the executive branch in the White House Counsel's office, and the portion of the Justice Department tends to venerate executive power. I believe the president has formidable authority in the national security area and foreign affairs. In fact, I suspect that Garrett and I disagree on issues like drones and NSA surveillance. But the notion that the president, where I believe a president has stronger powers, but the notion that the president can unilaterally borrow money on the credit of the United States, then that power is clearly assigned to Congress in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 2, is so remarkable. If the president were to do that, it would be a constitutional crisis. It would warp the separation of powers, and not to use too strong of a word, will be approaching a level of dictatorship. And by the way, I got news for you, Garrett. If the president tried to issue debt unilaterally, nobody would buy it, because I don't know of any lawyer who would write a legal opinion suggesting that such debt would be repaid.
So I would
love
to.
It would be an exercise in nullity. It would be a piece of paper. It would be, in effect, exactly like the Confederate debt that had pieces of paper attached to it, denominations, but it was unlawful at its inception. So that would not work in any case.
I would love to get one more call in if we could, gentlemen. Real interesting. And Stephen's been waiting in Rye. Hey, Stephen, go ahead. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air.
Thank you. Actually, I'm on 101 going to Manchester. But to go back to the earlier comment from a caller, that every time Congress passes a budget that's above the debt ceiling, they have failed in their job. And that's what the problem is, and that the Constitution may be failing there. Maybe we need the ability to impeach Congress when they fail consistently like this. If they're going to pass the debt ceiling limit, we should have every member of Congress get up there before they pass that vote and say, I have failed in my job what you're paying me to do, because I have passed a budget that is beyond what the debt ceiling limit has told us we can borrow. Now, I don't know where that fits in constitutionally, But that is the problem. We continually vote for a budget that's above the spending, and that's what's out of control. And we have a democracy that's just plain old not working. It's irrational not to be voting for the debt ceiling increase when we've already passed the budget. If they fail, they need to step up to the fact that they have failed in their job.
Stephen, thanks a lot for calling in. Garrett, lots of thoughts about the current situation, but also wondering what the Constitution says about Congress's obligation there. Go ahead, Garrett. Thanks, Stephen, for the call.
Well, I don't know of any place in the Constitution that says, oh, by the way, Congress really does need to pass a budget. Congress really does need to pass laws. I think, going back to, you know, what would upset the framers, I think the framers assumed that Congress would do its job just the way they assumed the president would do his job and the judiciary would do their job. And it's a very difficult situation to deal with a Congress or one house of a Congress that simply says, you know, like Bartleby the Scrivener, we prefer not to do our job. We prefer to not pass bills and then scream that the government has to shut down because we haven't passed bills. No constitution will work unless all the actors within its institutions conscientiously try to fulfill their responsibilities. There's no question in my mind that the House of Representatives is currently failing to fulfill its responsibilities, and that is true regardless of whether I agree or disagree about any given level of funding for any given program.
Can I ask you guys one last question, if I could? As this debt ceiling debate looms, we're going to hear a lot about the government defaulting and how that will hurt our credibility, you know, both in domestic financial markets and certainly international financial markets. What do you think, David Rivkin? What does that mean to default? And do you think it's going to happen?
No, it's not going to happen. I think in the end of the day, both the President and the Secretary of Treasury recognize what I think Garrett and I agree as to the true import of Section 4 of the 14th Amendment. To repeat, the United States is one country that is constitutionally incapable of defaulting, and Laura, to make it less highfalutin, under the Supreme Court teaching, under a case called Perry versus United States, if I had a bond on which Treasury, despite my expectations, failed to make a payment, we're not going to have a Latin American or Asian crisis. You can trot over to a federal court of claims, and you can get a money judgment out of a bottomless fund that's called the judgment fund. It will be paid. That is not an issue. I wish we would take this off the table. I wish the president would stop saying that we're in danger of default on public debt. That's not the true issue. The real issue is this. If there's no increase in debt ceiling, that would equate to a roughly 43, maybe even higher, percent cut in all the other government expenditures. It would be a catastrophe. I would be the first one to agree with that. We should avert this. But very important, let me say briefly, for your listeners to appreciate, it's not that the House has failed to pass appropriations bills. The House has passed appropriations bills every single time since this administration began in office. It's the Senate that has repeatedly failed to pass appropriations bills. So it's a little simplistic with respect to say the House is not doing its job. We have a fundamental disagreement between the Republican-controlled House and the Democrat-controlled Senate and the White House over the true scope of federal spending. Let's forget about Obamacare and all this other stuff. There are fundamental disagreements about level of federal spending, particularly in the entitlement area. The Republicans have been pressing for serious cutbacks. Whether you agree with them or not, that's their position. And all the reductions in federal spending that this administration and Democrats are claiming are illusory. We're spending, have your listeners just look at one simple number. We're spending more money every single year. 2008, 2009, every single year. They only engage in accounting gimmicks for which people in the private sector will go to jail if you seriously claim we're spending less money.
So default? Go ahead, Garrett. That's the last question. So go ahead, default.
I would say a couple of things. One is, in fact, the Senate has passed a budget. The House, you know, has refused to go to conference on that budget. So the idea that it's the Senate's job, I think, is a little off.
And beyond that,
That's right, but they did do it. You said they didn't.
Well, let's gentlemen.
Let me just finish another point. Let me just finish my point, David. We heard from you. The second thing is the current dispute is not about the debt. It is them, the Republicans in the House, saying we must have changes to or repeal of the Obamacare program. That's not a dispute about the debt. In 2011, at least that's what they were arguing about. Now it's just sort of, you know, give us what we want or we'll shoot this dog. And I think it is a failure, a shocking failure to do their job. And I will leave that to your listeners to decide which view is correct.
All right. Well, gentlemen, this has been great. And both of you, I want to let our listeners know, have written extensively on this. We're going to put articles from The Atlantic, from The Wall Street Journal, and other publications on our website by both our guests, David Rivkin and Garrett Epps. NHPR.org is the website. And again, we'll put some articles up there and you can take a look at them. NHPR.org. David Rivkin, thank you very much. I really appreciate you joining us this hour.
Pleasure to be with you.
David Rivkin served in the Justice Department during the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations. He's an attorney in Washington. He specializes in constitutional, administrative, and international litigation. And Garrett Epps, great to have you, too. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Garrett Epps, former reporter for The Washington Post, legal scholar, teaches constitutional law and creative writing at the University of Baltimore. Garrett Epps' books include Democracy Reborn, The 14th Amendment, and The Fight for Equal Rights in Post-Civil War America, also American Epic, Reading the U.S. Constitution. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Mikesell. Our volunteers are Priscilla Malcolm, John Barrett, and Alan Cohen. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. The federal government shutdown shows up in the Granite State with lots of questions about short and long-term impacts. New Hampshire experiences the rollout of the Affordable Care Act's new health insurance marketplaces, and Granite State equestrians protest proposed new rules about how and where they can ride. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show, next at 10 on NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from the new Farnham Center and Webster Place, committed to drug and alcohol treatment. More information online at estreatment.org. And from Tarm Biomass of Lyme, inviting everyone interested in home heating efficiency to visit the Green Buildings Open House Tour on Saturday, October 5th. Information at woodboilers.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEBS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
Good morning, it's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama met with House Republicans yesterday in an attempt to end their budget impasse. No progress reported, and the government shutdown entered its third day today. The president shortened his scheduled trip to Asia, signaling the White House is